Good morning. You're listening to KBOO FM, Portland. And this is More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. Today is Monday, July 24th, 2006.
Is that your cheat sheet?
That is.
That's all right. I was days ahead of myself in some of my readings. And so, and they had the date printed on them, and I still couldn't quite get it right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and so if you are awake and need to be at work at 8 o'clock, get to cracking.
Because
if you're not already on the road and scant minutes from your place of employment, you are late.
But, you know, I don't know if it's happened to other folks, but, you know, with the warm weather and it stays warm so
late.
Well into the evening, so I don't get comfortable until very early in the morning, and so
That's when I can get to sleep.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
You know, and unlike some folks, now if I've got central air in the building in which I live or reside, then I'm good with air conditioning, but it's not something I personally would purchase because my sinuses don't like it too much.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm old-fashioned. I got these giant fans. But sometimes giant fans require strategic placement, and still it takes a while. You know, to get it cooled down.
But hopefully people are taking care of themselves.
And, lots of water.
And, you know, there's no such thing as global warming.
No, not even. Not even. Forget about it. Isn't that what they say? Yes, you are listening to Your Community Connection as we wax about the heat. And if you are in points east, such as Hood River, the Dalles, White Salmon, Washington, you are listening to KBOO FM at 91.9. And if you are in the Willamette Valley and Corvallis, Albany, and Salem, that's when you get the 100.7. On the web, it is KBOO.FM. And if you don't have all the listening software, all you got to do is point and click and, you know, download it, and then you can listen to cable. You can tell your friends about cable. You can call in from long distances and wax poetic about cable, you know. Or if you're a long way away and you don't like us, you can just still send us a check because we're there, so you don't have to go out and hate and dislike strangers, you know.
Well, we wouldn't want that to happen. But as your community radio station, we want to make sure that we hear your voice and also that you participate as much as possible. So if you have news or announcements you would like to share with the community, please feel free to drop us a line or send it via the community calendar, and we'll make sure that your announcement of the community event is broadcast so others can know about it.
Yeah, well, 'tis the best of our power. Now, here's how that works. If you have an announcement and you think it's specifically germane to our show, you can send it to Celeste and Cecil. You can send it to More Talk Radio in Care Box 120, KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th, 97214. Or you can just send it to Community Calendar. Now, with Community Calendar, you're not necessarily guaranteed it's going to be read because we get tons of announcements, and the volunteers do their best to pick out those that are most relevant to our listening area that are timely, give enough lead time for them to do production, et cetera, et cetera. So if you've got something and you know about it a month in advance and you think cable listeners need to know, we need to have it as soon as possible. And it used to be that you could post directly to the website. I believe that option might still be available. I'll have to go back and visit it again. The website's been updated, so I haven't visited all of the areas. But take time to check it out, and you can find our website, as we said, at www.kboo.fm, and do some point-and-click exploration.
Well, we've been talking about the weather and how hot it is, and you know, this is community radio. We don't want it to be too cold, so
what are we doing? We are afflicting the comfortable
and
comforting the afflicted. Yeah.
So it might involve a little afflicting today.
Yeah, I think it might be some affliction going on today. One of the things that we like to do here on More Talk Radio is to create a forum of discussion of things that are not always talked about. Now, there are things that are popular and things that are unpopular, but they still get talked about. Here in the wonderful, great Pacific Northwest, where we pride ourselves in being open-minded and thinkers outside of the box, there are some ways in which we are not only in the box, but the box is sealed up tight, very tight, unfortunately. And so it does not allow or provide for the change necessary to bring about a lot of the vision that the people in the Pacific Northwest sometimes pride themselves on having. What a conundrum, you know. What a contradiction in terms. For example, here's a declaration. Racism, discrimination, bigotry, they're over. Gone, done, finis, kaput, thing of the past. Equality is a reality. And that's very true now. Think about it. Everybody can have a cell phone or a car. So if that's true, why then are one of the, I won't say historically, because that might raise a few eyebrows, but I will say one of the most downtrodden and aggrieved minorities in this country, that being those of African descent, why are blacks complaining? Everything is better now. We have good schools, great education, opportunity to get any job that we can aspire to go places. Right? Right? Well, here in the Pacific Northwest, I have an article to read to you that will help really support how far we have come as people. It's a commentary out of the Wednesday, June 2006, Oregonian. It started in 1997 as an uninformed judgment of a coworker, a woman employee of Portland's Bureau of blank, 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 services, saw Lisa Washington and Roxy Granville walking downtown. The two black women were considered hardworking, well-spoken, well-liked by most of their coworkers. Their performance reviews proved they did their jobs well. But someone assumed that because the two friends were on break at the same time, they must be doing something wrong. So a supervisor later scolded the two women who worked as a position here in our greater city. You two were seen together, they were told. Washington's response? What law was broken? Did someone see us jaywalking? Was there a citizen's complaint? None of the above. Still, the complaint warranted a policy directive. Check with your supervisor before you take a break or leave the office. Okay. That rule led to 2 years of facilitated group meetings where other co-workers also complained. Two black staff are friends outside of work, and they appear close and too cliquish, reads the facilitator's report. Another directive was issued. Employees need a supervisor's permission to walk or ride with a co-worker. More meetings. Another supervisor again reportedly told the women that they were violating company policy by being seen together so much. More meetings. Another policy. Get permission before you go on-site visits. But Washington and Granville complained that white employees did not have to check in and out. You're thinking, am I crazy or are these other people crazy? Granville says. But I'm not doing anything wrong but being me. There's nothing wrong with being me. In March 2002, Granville was placed on a month of administrative leave for calling a transgendered male co-worker a she, despite reports that others who did the same went unpunished. Granville also received a written reprimand and a job transfer. In 2002, Granville and Washington sued in federal court for racial discrimination and violating their constitutional rights to free speech and association. The proof was never hostile, overt, or pervasive, but they said it had been steady, poignant, and selective enough to get their attention. At one point, Washington, a former union leader, who was a high school cheerleading coach, little league softball coach, and a volunteer member of another important service here in our community, took an 18-month leave from work. I was devastated that I was being judged by the color of my skin, Washington says. I'm labeled in a negative way, even though I'm a productive member of society. On June 6th, a trial began and lasted 1 week. On Tuesday, nearly 4 years after the suit was filed and 9 years after the first official complaint, a jury unanimously ruled in their favor, and they were awarded significant damages. But the victory is bittersweet. They said they're happy that they were finally vindicated, but said that the experience made them gain weight, lose sleep, and battle depression. It's not easy. It takes a toll on you. The two women, though, like what they do for a living, have no intention of quitting. They still work in the same place with some of the same co-workers and supervisors. The supervisor of that area met with the employees as part of the regular scheduled staff meetings. I'm hoping that if those same kind of circumstances existed today, that we have systems now in place that wouldn't evolve to the point of a lawsuit. Maybe not. But an absence of conflict doesn't always translate into racial harmony. And managers of any workplace can change policies, but policies can't change closed minds. So we say discrimination doesn't exist. We say bigotry is all a matter of perspective. We say racism is a thing of the past. There is free and open access to all of the marketplaces that this great country has to offer. But are we telling the truth? And there are a few other things to consider. Whenever we try to discuss issues of race or discrimination, bigotry, and inequality, the conversation is automatically skewed. And that prevents an open and fair and honest discussion that could actually lead to some progress. For example, if a black person or any person of color brings up the issue, sometimes the mere bringing it up allows the issue to be skewed in such a way that a false dichotomy is created, and automatically it's an offensive statement that's made. It is construed as a statement that ignores or devalues all the progress that has been made. And that's not necessarily true. The point is to bring out that the playground is not yet equal. The field is still full of potholes or rises. Sometimes, if a white person brings up the conversation, they're viewed as a traitor. They're viewed as a traitor not just to the race, but their economic and social standing. Or it's again construed in a way that makes it less than productive. Another false dichotomy might be brought up. And the issue then might be, well, I didn't own any slaves. My parents didn't. So what is there for me to do? And the issue of looking at privilege, looking at assumptions that a person's selfhood is valuable, the issue of looking at a human being just as a human being and trying to find the value in all that that person can offer and working to help them realize all of their potential is rarely considered. I mean, to use an analog, women still only earn a fraction, albeit a bigger fraction now, of the dollar that a man earns. It's the value of that person. So we look at how can we get out of those tightly closed boxes, how can we get out of those tightly closed minds, and ask a few questions. And the questions revolve around this. In terms of really opening up the issues of racial discrimination, bigotry, inequality in this country, and getting the discussion of race out and open, and removing some of the false dichotomies, such, for example, that the race issue in this country is just on black and white, or why is it, looking at the black issue, let's look at some really key issues. What does it take for those members of society who do not see discrimination, who do not recognize that it's real, what will it take for you to recognize the reality of it and feel comfortable in working to dismantle it? For those who recognize it, how can we shape the conversation to keep it from falling into these false polarities and to make it a meaningful and progressive discussion without bringing up other issues or allowing other issues, tangential issues, to creep in? How can we gain a meaningful power base in this city or in this country or in this world so that we can address the fact that there are human beings that regardless of how much they or their families or anyone of the same color or culture or ethnicity as they have contributed to a society are still valued as less than equal? And those are some of the questions that we'll ask. And we know that in this short time, we're not going to get this whole conversation addressed. And we've actually got three articles here that we're going to try to address. And so we know that this will be a continuing conversation. Now, let me, quote unquote, pay the bills, and then we'll go to our very patient callers. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 here in the greater metropolitan area in Portland, and the Columbia River Gorge, 91.9, and the Willamette River Valley, 100.7, on the web, kboo.fm, More Talk Radio with Cecil and myself, Celeste. And we'll go to our first caller. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you, Celeste and Cecil?
I'm enjoying the heat.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because you got to file it back because it does rain and get cold here. And then I can just access that memory. Bam, there I am on my own personal holodeck.
Okay.
I am not enjoying the heat. But
I'm with you.
I'm sure you have something more important to share with us this morning.
I'm with you, Cecil. Thank you, first of all, for bringing the subject up. I just want to acknowledge you both for, you know, this is one of the few shows, if only shows, on KBOO that actually takes on this subject on a regular basis. I can't think of another that actually does. So I appreciate that. And these questions are very important because, you know, we're living in a system, under a system that is, you know, privilege, racism, white supremacy is this invisible system. Part of the brilliance of it is that it's a system that is invisible in the sense that in the past it was overt. In the past the laws reflected an overt, oppressive, racist agenda. Now they've scrubbed the overt parts of it so that people believe that because we've removed the whites only signs, that racism no longer exists. And in fact, I think the system is much more powerful because it has made people think that it doesn't exist. They have found a way to maintain the system, if not more so. You know, it's probably stronger than it ever was, but they've created this idea in the minds of people, white people, that it doesn't exist. Many black people don't think racism, white supremacy exists. And so, you know, you have a large job if you're trying to let people know who don't want to believe that it exists in the first place. You know, you've got people who, white folks, who want to think that this is a meritocracy, that they only get stuff because they work hard. You know, I've gotten everything I get because I'm a hard working person. And if everybody worked like I did or like we do, they'd get stuff too. Now, those of us who know better know that that's not exactly the truth. But because the hand or the invisibility of privilege and racism has been kind of enshrined, you have people who don't even, you can tell them, you know, for years about what you've experienced, but it'll always be a matter of, well, just work harder. There's no system. There's no system of racism. There's no system of white privilege. So we have a difficult task. You have many, like I said, I'll say this and shut up. You have many people of color who have bought into the indoctrination, into the brainwashing that, you know, yeah, all you have to do is work harder. And on a certain level, that is true. I'm not going to say that it is not true. But there is a system. It does exist. And as you noted in your story, Celeste, I mean, that's the power of the system. When you've got people who can enforce discriminatory behavior and don't even realize they're doing it, and you tell that kind of a story where black people are subject to the most absurd kinds of restrictions based on race, but it's not based on race. You know, they're just rules. So they de-race rule, so it looks like, oh, we're just trying to maintain order. We're just trying to enforce colorless rules, and of course, it's enforced on people of color. I mean, it's pure insanity. So, I'm very interested to hear what you all have to say about it, and the rest of the callers have to say. Thanks.
All right. Well, thank you for your call.
Thank you for your call, and you certainly raise identify some questions around racism and how it exists, and commenting on the article Celeste shared in terms of racism manifesting itself differently today than in times past. Raises two questions for me. One, he talks about the invisibility of racism, and so a question I would ask is, at a former time, was it more visible? And therefore, and people acknowledged it, is the part of the problem today is not only that it's invisible, but people say that it doesn't exist. At one point, people were, racism was the system and everyone acknowledged it. Today, it seems as if he was saying, and as the article you read suggested, that it continues to exist, but people pretend that it is a system that that does not.
Without belaboring the point, it did exist. If you take the whole institution of slavery and you slide it out of the equation for just a moment, and you look at the immediate post-slavery era, where after the 13th Amendment had abolished slavery, you have what is on paper, by law, supposed to be an equal playing field. That's when you start seeing the machinery of discrimination and racism start to come into play. That's when you had to take people who were not people and who were suddenly people and had quote-unquote, full access to the system, and find another way to keep them from fully accessing the system. Okay. Now, the only way you can do that and maintain that is to create a system of rules and laws that will pass that initial scan that says it either looks like it's still slavery or it doesn't. And there were ways you could do that. Some of them, well, like I said, so I don't belabor the point, were issues like poll taxes, or you had to have your parents and your grandparents had to have not been slaves, or various other ways that were aimed at keeping blacks from having full access. And a lot of those became codified and called the Jim Crow laws. Those were overt. And then there was the covert means, which were the social mores of the time. So you look at that, and the reason I take slavery out is just because that really does change the dynamic. You can't even compare it to the immediate post, because the immediate post, as I said, was predicated on the fact that suddenly these beings who are property are now people, and they're supposed to have full, total access by law. So yes, it was overt, and now it's less covert. One of the ways it's less covert is because Jim Crow laws have systematically been, to a degree, removed. Some of our quote-unquote Jim Crow laws were only just removed in the past few years here in this state.
Well, some people might want to also say that Jim Crow laws are being reintroduced, in such as, I know we wanted to talk about this perhaps later, but mm-hmm. in terms of the move for voter ID.
Voter ID is one. And if you're, and I'm having a rolling blackout, but our guest who we had on there who was promoting his book, was it Norm that we had that was promoting his book? And he was, it'll come to me
it
in a moment.
Come, but,
he was
yeah.
talking basically about segregation of kids in school by class. And class, though, is not racism. It is part and parcel. It's a adjunct tool of racism.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. Our phone numbers are 503-231-8187. And
before we go to Carla, let me read another quote in here from another article. This is from Daryl Milner, who is a professor of Black Studies here at Portland State University. And that's the fact that Portland likes to look at itself as a progressive place. And I think that the fact that there are no Black in high positions in the city, only two that head up bureaus within the city, it's a fact that calls for some soul searching. What is the issue here? You know, and that, again, you look at the fact that we're talking about issues of meritocracy, issues of access, issues of people's internal perceptions of each other and the value of each other, and whether or not a person is enough of value to go against the societal systemic rules that oppress or keep that person from having full access.
Currently, there are no African Americans serving on Multnomah County Board of Commissioners or the Metro Council. No one in Oregon's congressional delegation is Black. None of the six people in the top spots of the state government executive branch is African American. As Celeste mentioned, only two of the bureaus.
Yeah, two city bureaus.
Headed by African Americans. Let's go to our next caller and let's hear what you have to say. Thank you for your patience. You are on the air.
I just want to acknowledge, I'm so moved by this program and so grateful that Celeste, I tuned in just probably 5 minutes before you were finished speaking and took a caller and to acknowledge the caller. I have been a KBOO member for a number of years and have recently returned to Portland after living out of the state for a few years. So I'm so interested that now in 2006, you're having the courage to bring up again the issues of racism in this community. I am a woman of color. I'm Arab American. And I know that if I'm feeling uncomfortable in my own city many, many times, that African Americans in this community have been suffering racism also. I'm wondering if there's a possibility or if there's been any conversation generated at KBOO about KBOO volunteers and programmers and program hosts participating in the Anglo managers and programmers participating in Unlearning Racism workshops. I probably everybody has at some point or another, but I'm wondering if people would be interested in that. A very longtime dear friend of mine who I don't have too much contact with these days, I would imagine would be willing to do that work, Cliff Jones. He's a very wonderful leader in the Portland community, an African-American man who speaks to racism very well. You know, I turn on in the morning, I turn on in the afternoon, and there's certain hosts that I really can't listen to, even though I know they're well-meaning. Our community's more gentrified now because we are more international with a heavier weight on Anglos coming from other communities and coming with money. And that diversity is really powerful and beautiful in some way, and what's happening on Alberta Street and Mississippi Street is supposed to be really wonderful. But, you know, there it needs to be addressed why it is still painful for people and what our community, what pieces of our community are saying. And I can imagine that there would be community members, particularly from the African-American community, who, if invited in a nurturing environment, would speak on KBOO about their experience. It just feels to me like KBOO, over the last few the years that I've been gone, has leaned a little more toward... oh, aren't we great, these white community? We're such a liberal white community, and oh, we just host these people of color, and we just, oh yes, we have these wonderful African American people in our community. But the tone and the ability to really listen when someone speaks and has something to say that's powerful and clean and clear and wise, it has become less often for me on the talking parts of KBOO Radio. So if there's a way I can support you, I want to. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for your call. You know, point of fact, both when I was just a volunteer and then when I served on the board, I had Cliff Jones in for a couple of issues. The station, to its credit of its own volition, the station management, that is, has had people come in, trainers come in, speakers come in to lead various components of the KBOO membership board, volunteer staff through issues of racism. However, KBOO is a microcosm of the world, and that means that there are this kind of maintenance needs to be done. We have our own issues here. We are not without fault, and actually one of the upcoming topics on the show is born out of a cultural conflict that we had at the station, in which we had issues with people who felt that those who had English as a second language and had an accent should not be over-the-air broadcasters, should not be reading the news, should not be doing community calendar or hosting shows because they were, quote-unquote, too difficult to understand. As if any of us speak the quote-unquote Queen's English. You know, and so not to beat the organization up that I work so hard for, but because I love and want to help it to be all it can be, you know, that's an issue that also needs to be addressed. Some of the points that the caller brought up about afflicting the comfortable, because KBOO, like Portland, has become comfortable in its quote-unquote liberality, its liberal progressive attitude, that it does not see the oppression that it maintains or that it buys into. And so we have to have that reflective moment where we look at ourselves and say, oh, I think we need an adjustment. what was that movie called? Color Adjustment by Marlon Riggs.
Marlon Riggs.
That color adjustment, and perhaps that's exactly what we need. And you know, given that it takes long-term listeners, long-term volunteers, like the caller who was just in, or you know, or any callers ahead of time, to go back to that original question that I asked: what does it take for us to start having that meaningful conversation? What does white America need to hear? You know, and then bear in mind that folks of color may not be willing to always be the ambassador through the wilderness of ignorance and bigotry. You know, sometimes there's an expectation that there's going to be some personal work and effort put into this, and that we don't always have to point the way, you know, like some Sherpa guide here.
We are opening up the discussion to talk about racism here in our community. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187, and we hope that you give us a call and put in your viewpoints on this important subject. We're given some freedom in terms of length of discussions because we want to hear what you have to say. So we'll go to our next caller, and thank you for your patience. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, this may seem a little frivolous compared to the other issues you're talking about, but are you guys, you follow the comics in the Oregonian?
Not anymore. They stop making me laugh. And when they stop making me laugh or think or ponder, you know, and I actually tried to read them a few days ago, and it just, and then I'm done. So, no, I don't read them anymore.
Well, do you remember that comic strip, Curtis?
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm. It's not there anymore.
Oh, that's kind of scary.
They took it out, I think, last week.
What's its replacement?
Oh, something kind of dumb. And it's a local comic strip, and it's, I don't know. There's a whole bunch of these new comic strips that really don't do much for me. I kind of like Curtis.
Describe Curtis for
listeners. And if there was some type of pivotal moment why they took it out, if you know.
Well, okay. Curtis, he's a little black kid, you know, probably about 10 years old, 12, and he's got a little brother, he's a tattletale.
Mm-hmm.
His dad works for the Motor Vehicles Bureau, and it's sort of a whole family and neighborhood, you know. He's got this girl, well, he's lusting after this girl, Michelle, who's going to be a superstar someday. And there's all these different characters. It was a kind of a continuing storyline. And I just thought it was a kind of an interesting comic strip. I enjoyed reading it. I read about half the comics that are in the Oregonian.
Well, I think one thing that was important about Curtis, just in terms of how it might have been a different comic, that each year during the celebration of Kwanzaa,
a special
presentation in terms of a Kwanzaa. So
yeah,
it had,
that was always interesting.
Curtis is also, he was political.
Yes, very.
He was a political young man. He wasn't just engaged in some of the typical surface activities that kids are sometimes inclined to. He was a deep thinker, you know, and that's not to say that at times that he wasn't just funny and he wasn't just a goofy kid enjoying life at that age. But sometimes it was deeply political, and he'd have his moments.
A conflict with his father over youth and adult culture.
Yeah.
Oh, and smoking and rap.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's missing now. Well, you know, that's.
Well, what they did is, I guess, the Oregonian, they had a survey, you know. They had these little forms every day for a couple of weeks, you know, what is the comic strip you like or, you know, want to see replaced. And I guess that one came out at the low end, which I don't know. I'm not sure exactly what that means as far as the culture goes. I noticed there's a couple of comic strips that were sort of dropped from the comic page last year or something, and they're sort of there among the classified ads. You know, like Judge Parker.
That's,
you know,
a classic.
That's
my
one of the latest comic strips I've ever seen. Anyway.
You know, people use Judge Parker as a game. They cut out, you know, the squares of it and shake them up and use them as random, what they call it, 8-ball fortune tellers.
Yeah.
That's about what it's good for, huh?
Anyway, I just kind of a little miffed that they dropped that comic strip. I'm just wondering how other folks feel about it.
Okay.
Well, thanks for the call.
You bet.
And write to editor and tell them that, well, you liked Curtis.
Yeah, well, yes. Well, I sent in my little, part of the survey and everything, and, I guess there wasn't enough people. Okay, thanks. Okay.
All right, thanks for your call.
This is More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. We're addressing the issue of racism here in our community and how this discussion may take place. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187, and we'll go to our next caller. Caller, thank you for waiting.
Good morning.
Good morning, Cecil.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And good morning, Celeste. It's so good to hear you, and it's so good to hear this topic brought up. I don't want to get away from the Black Dennis the Menace comic strip being pulled, and I don't want to get away from the local scene where we're one of the whitest cities in America. There's a 7% African American population, but I do want to take out my telescope and look at the greater planet. I've always said that racism is the leading problem in our world today. It's ahead of all things, even greed, all of that. Racism is the leading divisive element amongst us. And if you look at the deeper planet and you see what I call the terrible nexus of racism and misogyny, the hatred of women,
mm-hmm.
and though that nexus is in Africa, you have Southeast Asian and Chinese men buying Russian women over the Internet. You have European and North American men buying Asian women over the Internet. Or I put that in a way that isn't quite accurate. I mean, buying, but I mean, you know, whole buying services and sex tourism and everything.
And in some instances, buying them outright. You're right.
Right. And the horrible part is that in Africa, nobody is buying African women. In fact, if you have in your mind the slightest bit of conspiracy theory, they are being allowed to die in devastating numbers. It is the true nexus of racism and misogyny on the planet. And to bring it back to a local viewpoint, you're absolutely right about the number of African Americans in government, in the local government. There aren't just in the local bureaus and bureaucracies. We need more elected and high profile officials for sure, but we're such a fake liberal city, you know. It's all. Are you there?
Yeah, we're listening to you.
It sounds as if you're breaking up.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me get my little thing off here. I'm using the earpiece. Is that better?
Oh, that's better. Yes, that's better.
I'm using one of those earpieces because my phone gets hot. It's a cell phone, and then I get scared about brain cancer.
No, for that reason,
yeah. But the artificial liberality of Portland has always stunned me since I moved here almost a decade ago. It's look at us. We're so cool. We're so liberal. We're so progressive. And yet it's one of the whitest cities in America, and it's run by people who are feel-good liberals. They're not. I don't want to hear any more about how they feel good. I want to see some action on the ground. I live in North Portland, and I love it, and I want to see more things happen with African-American ownership. Ownership. Ownership is everything. Thanks very much.
I would thank you for your call. You know, to basically just kind of recap what the caller said about misogyny and racism hand in hand, it goes right back to what I was saying earlier is, what is it about us as human beings that we're more content to feel good than to actually go through whatever effort is required of us at a deep level to value another human being? It goes right back to what I said earlier about the fact that women still in this country only earn a fraction of what men have. Yeah, it's more than it used to be. What is it, roughly? It's more than 75 cents on the dollar, but not much more. And in some parts of the country, it might be a little less. And so that speaks to the value of the human being. And we set up these systems so we don't have to value the person. We look at any way we can capitalize on someone's work or capitalize on various features of the person, but never actually value them. In many of the countries that the caller mentioned, you have women looked at as a commodity. If they're being commodified, you know, I guess sometimes I find myself at a loss of words because the inhumanity of it is just so obvious. It's so overt. You wonder on a small level, you know, you go back to a community that prides itself on being so progressive. How do you police and pull those roots out of yourself? Because it's it's pointless to march. It's pointless to have these political fits and spurts of progression if we're not going to really be honest about them and address some of the root causes. For Portland to be a quote-unquote white city, what makes it that? Is it the fact that there are few folks of color that have access to power, access to ownership? Is there a system that keeps it this way? Well, let's remember, this was an exclusion state. That meant that blacks were not supposed to be here. And if you came and your job had ended, you're supposed to move post-haste. Is that part of it? What are we doing as a quote-unquote progressive community to address that?
The caller also mentioned the importance of home ownership, and he also mentioned he lives in North Portland. Related to this is the one might say the destruction of the African American community historically here, and not only
but
historically. Mm-hmm. For those of you who are in the Portland metro area, you might be aware of what has happened, especially in the African American community since World War II until the present. He alluded to gentrification that has taken place, and we are perhaps more familiar of what's taken place more recently. You mentioned Alberta and Mississippi, but historically that has happened. So that's also a part in this whole discussion.
Well, you know, just to mention specifically what that is for folks so that they'll have a jumping off place, there was a time that the area that is where the Coliseum used to be part of a thriving black business community. Most of the property along Broadway as you enter into downtown were black owned businesses. And you can go back and look in the city archives and find that out. And,
Williams and, Union Avenue, Williams,
right.
And
uh-huh.
were a thriving business and also residential area.
Right. And so when you have the highway coming in, when you have the Coliseum coming in, Emmanuel Hospital coming in, vast amounts of black residents were moved out of that area. What made that significant is that was the Portland Reservation. You couldn't go anywhere else. Once Vanport had been flooded and destroyed, all the black population was settled in that part of town and were not allowed to go anywhere else. You could not buy property anywhere else. And you had to have a white cosigner sometimes to get property anywhere close to the fringe areas. And so when it's like any population, when they've been relegated to an area and then told they got to get out of that area too, there's a resistance, there's a frustration, there's a resentment, there's a lot of unresolved upsets and hurts. And if that was somebody that you really valued just on a personal level, you would take lots of steps to resolve that. But here in our wonderful city that has so much to offer, we're not addressing those issues. And so, you know, the question again is, how do we start having an honest conversation? What key points need to be addressed before we are willing to put down our weapons and put down the cruel words and put down the fake liberality and to put down the defensiveness and the structures that have been built both overtly and covertly, and honestly address it so that we can have full access and recognize human potential? We'll go to our next caller. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, yes. I just wanted to also say that another aspect of why the black community has been disintegrating is banks used to redline that community.
Yes.
Back in the day, properties over there. Well, actually,
up into 2000s. What
right.
do you mean back in the day? Up into 2000s.
Yeah, they couldn't get a loan over. If the house had to be over a certain amount of money. I think back when I tried to apply for it, it's like the loan had to be at least over $40,000. They was redlining it. Blacks couldn't get loans because they said the property value over there wasn't worth much. But the media, in conjunction with the City Hall was driving the property values down. they drove the property values down so low until you had people like Habitat for Humanities and all these other groups coming in there under the pretense of beautifying the community, doing things over there in the community. And basically what they Habitat for Humanity has done, bought up a bunch of properties, renovated them, and then made loans or these homes available to the European population.
Well, not just whites. There are a lot of blacks who live in those Habitat homes.
Well, a few of them, but there's other groups over there doing it, too. I know this stuff firsthand because I've been deeply involved in the real estate aspect. So I've seen that stuff take place. There was a time back in the 70s, realtors wouldn't even take white people over into Northeast Portland to show them houses. They put that area down. Mm-hmm. All the way up until, I guess, the 80s.
Until the 80s.
Yeah.
80s. Up until about 85 or so. Uh-huh.
And now gentrification is coming. It's there. And as older blacks move out, no other new blacks are buying. The younger blacks aren't buying, at least over there. And they come in, with the young Europeans.
Well, I think there's, and perhaps I would like to hear your thought about that. My impression was that at one point when you talked about the red line and then they didn't show whites that neighborhood, when the property values went down so fast, then people, hop onto older black homeowners, and many of them sold their houses for really low amount of money. Then the resold them to newer residents, and now the property values of some of those homes are so high that lower income African Americans cannot afford to live in those communities.
That is true, and that's not an accident. I mean, when they made a conscious effort to put the police station over there on MLK, mm-hmm. when if they really wanted to help their community, they would have put things to train people for jobs. They would have put those type. They would have sent social workers over there. They would have put work release type, on the job type training programs over there. When they didn't do that and they came there with the police station, well, historically, whenever the European wants something, they put up a fort. And then once the fort is there, then they go out and they conquer the natives. And so the police station is a modern day fort. So once they put that fort there, then they could go and battle crimes because white people wouldn't go move over there as long as those gang members was roaming around and the reservation was a little violent. They weren't going to move over there, so they had to get rid of the gangs. They had to put a police presence over there so white folks would feel comfortable about moving over there. So when you saw that come in, that was the beginning of gentrification. Now, also, you talk about racism. In order to understand this whole thing about racism, you have to understand the European mentality. You have to understand where the European came from. They came out of feudalism. They came out of a system that was based on kings and queens and serfs. And they came from an area of Europe that was poor, famines. They had all kind of, it wasn't a wealthy nation. So they had to go out into the world and participate in conquest. Everything that the European has today, you can find that has all been brought about through conquest. And one of the elements of their conquest, of course, is racism, because they're targeting the people that have what they wanted was people of color. Africa, rubber for their tires, gold, diamonds. I mean, you just name it. It's all over in Africa. Oil, they're all over the Middle East. People of color, everything that they needed or wanted, people of color had it. So it was easy to come up with racism because now racism is another process of justification.
So how do we move beyond just talking about the history of it and start constructing some tools to deconstruct it?
Well, you're not going to move beyond it until you have to deal with the institutions.
Because well, how do we start dismantling the institution? Because we're really familiar with a lot of the history about the inception and the use of the implementation of racism. But what we want to do now is go look at its foundation and start dismantling it. So if you wanted to dismantle it, what would you do?
Well, let me give you an example of something. I went, actually a week ago, to the Civil Rights Department, about an issue, actually. And when I went in there, I never saw people that is affected by racism over there with those jobs. I saw Europeans over there, people that is unaffected by racism. So when you have a complaint and want to deal effectively with racism, you have to go in and try to talk to people that don't have no concept of it. That's one of the fallacies of this. They need to start putting people, really, the salvation in America really is people.
Hello?
I'm here.
Oh, okay.
We didn't hear the last part of what you said, the salvation of America.
To really changing things in America has to come from people of color. People that are oppressed, they are the people that have to come up with the new models. When you talk about liberals...
So tell us a little, just really briefly, because we want to get to our next caller.
Okay.
What is one aspect of a model, a new model?
One aspect of a new model is you have to have black people in key positions. That's one. But white people ain't voting them in, though. They keep voting the same things. And when you talk about progressives, I'm gonna tell you what the average white progressive is. They'll come on your show and they'll use precious airtime talking about animal rights, talking about trees and birds and fishes. Come on now. And they're not even dealing with human issues. But they'll dedicate a whole show to animals and trees and birds. These are liberals. That's the kind of mentality you got to get away from. You got it. And that's the kind of white liberal mentality that's out there.
Okay. Well, thank you for your call. So, in other words, it comes back again. Let's focus on the human value. Let's look at human issues, you know, not go far from home. We don't have to go anywhere across the country, anywhere across the world, rather, but look at the issues at home. So one of the points that the caller brought up is people who understand the plight of those who are afflicted to take the complaints.
Yes.
Okay, now, let me kind of flip that on the other side. Okay, so you have more people of color in those kinds of institutions where you're taking complaints and try to address the grievances. I want to go back to the article. You have two black women who are doing nothing but hanging together during their break time, and they're being cliquish. Now, where does that leave us, white listeners, if you've got more people of color who are taking the grievances? How comfortable are you? Are you going to be afraid then that there's going to be friends, letting in friends to complain for no particular reason? Or are you going to be willing to open your eyes and work with folks to establish some processes and procedures to take in these concerns, make sure that everyone's concern is legitimately processed, and then work with the complaints that come in as they complain? Or are you going to be afraid that folks are going to stack the deck?
One thing I find fascinating about the article is the perception of people, and just the fact that these two African-American women together outside of the workplace, it was as if they were conspiring together to take over the plantations.
Yeah. You know, and that's another issue that goes right back to the very beginnings when we talk about the difficulty of how to dismantle the whole idea of racism. If any of the isms are put in place to keep those who have from losing what they have taken, then that mentality really speaks strongly to it. The laws used to be that blacks were not allowed to congregate unless the master had said that's okay. So that meant the only time you could congregate basically was in church. you know, because church was supposed to be a mediating institution, something that was to calm the savage breast, you know. So if you don't have those laws anymore keeping us from meeting, but you still have that same social standard, we're not making any progress. Does that make sense to people? The more things change, the more they have not, the more they stay the same, you know. So it goes back to that issue again about our mindset and the value of a human being. And what is it about the color of somebody's skin that when you see more than two or three people gathered together, you automatically assume insurrection? And we have to address these, because these all go to the root of having property, acquiring things, keeping other folks from having access, and looking at where you are on the spectrum and how can you be of assistance so that everybody receives the same treatment. It becomes fair and all human beings are valued.
Our numbers are 503-231-8187. Let me remind you that coming up this morning at 9 is the OMO Variety Hour with interviews from the underground. At 10, the local naturopath, Dr. David Naiman, will host Health Watch. 10:30, Chris Andre hosts Earth Watch. And 11, listen to Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Let's go to our next caller. Thank you for your patience.
Hello.
Good
Hi morning.
There.
But what I want to say, we have a social structure that manufactures scarcity in order to enforce greed and selfishness.
And manufactures scarcity to enforce greed and selfishness.
Yeah.
Okay, you're right.
We racism and misogyny are tools that they then use to establish the group of people who don't turn around and figure all that out. That racism and misogyny are used to direct the people who they don't want to have immediate control over and who they don't want to give all of the benefits that they keep to themselves.
So let me ask you a question then. Now that we know that, because we know this, we study it, we analyze it, we chart it, we teach it. Knowing this, where is a good place for us to start dismantling it? What would you see as one or two steps that we could start dismantling or shifting the mindset?
Okay. We need to recognize that at this point, the whole world and everything that lies in it is our neighborhood and our community, and we have to start loving our neighbors as we love ourselves and refusing to accept that whole trip that's put down on us to be afraid of those people over there because they're not like us, that we have to share with everybody or else we are all going to have a great deal less.
I think you address the issue very pointedly and fundamentally in terms of recognizing that the whole world is our community, and that very basic principle we often talk about but very rarely practice, loving our neighbors as ourselves.
Yeah, we have to figure out how to teach that, and I don't have easy answers.
Well, you know, just reiterating that, just reminding people that sometimes is a very powerful tool in and of itself. And then reminding people, as we look at our progressive views, as we look at our desire to move forward and to progress and progress toward equality and access to business and access to education and access to home ownership or whatever the other fundamental needs or dreams we have, is to create an open playing field by not taking advantage of privilege when you can and by advocating for somebody who is being denied when you see it. Well, thank you so much for your call.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
And we'll go to our next caller. Caller, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Turn your radio down.
Yes.
There you go.
Yes, sir. This is about employment. Many years ago, I was an accountant, and there was a CPA that came to look at the books from the Internal Revenue Service. And he told us that the only employment he could get as a certified public accountant was with the government, and specifically with the Internal Revenue Service. Now, for years I've been going to CPA meetings. I've hardly ever seen any black faces at the CPA meetings. And increasingly, there are lots of women, lots of Asians. And the women may have talked up a lot of conversation, but I don't think Asians have been big in conversations with the white people, but somehow they've made it into the system. And that's my comment.
I'm not quite sure how to process that. I mean, with regard to women having access, as unpolitically correct as it is, it can be documented that women, and I am a woman, benefited from equal opportunity, equal rights, etc., and sometimes at the expense and the opportunity of people of color. And so, yeah, that's one issue, you know, but...
Well, and he also raised the issue in terms of in that particular field.
How hard it was.
How hard it was and how difficult. And I always want to ask the question, why aren't there more more faces at those CPA meetings who are African Americans? Mm-hmm. And to say that there's a relatively, for example, in this region, there's a relatively small African American population, begs the question of more representation of African Americans in you know, a variety of fields, including certified public accountants.
Well, you know, one of the things that's in another one of the articles that we have, it speaks to the fact that they said that there's a difficulty in finding people of color who are qualified. Now, I've heard that same thing said on hiring committees here at the radio station, and I'm amazed because there's not enough effort being made to look at the places where you have blacks who have the qualifications. One case in point, about 3 or 4 months ago, I had on a program, Proverbial Perspectives, members of the Diversity Fellows. The Diversity Fellows are part of the Institute of Nonprofit Management, which is a department in, I think it's the School of Business Administration with Portland State University, that works with leaders of color of nonprofit agencies or people in a management or a departmental head position. Some of these people have gone on to become executive directors of various nonprofits. Some of them left the nonprofit field and worked for the city government, for the county government, for the state government. Now, on average, I'd say they churn out, 15 or 20 a year. Mm-hmm. You know, conservative estimate. Now, that's just one venue. How is it that we have people who are educated, who are the leaders of our community, who don't know that and don't take the time to find it out? I found out about it, and I'm not going to hold myself up as a paragon of investigative, you know, excellence. I'm just somebody that has a basic common sense, you know, has some education in the field, and knows how to look for things and starts looking. Where would you find qualified candidates of color? To the city's credit, it is also working on a leadership academy with regard to how to access power for folks of color through the city venues. However, there are a lot of venues that just go untapped, and the answer, when you look at the paucity of faces of color, you know, especially blacks, but faces of color across the board, is, well, there just aren't enough qualified candidates. And that's an insult. That speaks to a lack of commitment to look, to do due diligence and trying to find out who is out there, what's available. When I hear the station say things such as that, you know, when we sit down and we talk with folks, oh, no, don't say that. What are your outreach efforts? How have you designed your outreach efforts? Are you designing your, are you bringing in people of color to help you design your outreach efforts? Because if you are using the white networking system to reach people of color, you're not going to catch them, because most of the times we don't have access to the same venues. So we're not going to necessarily be there, nowhere to go, know how to do it. There are lots of ways that we can dismantle the process. It's a matter of the will to do it. And the systems are out there. It's just the will to invest and commit. And that's where we start looking. But we have a full bank of callers. We have about 10 minutes. This is where it gets really tight. So you got about 2 minutes apiece, unfortunately. That'll give us a chance to get everybody in. And don't worry, this is an ongoing conversation. We will be bringing this one up for a bit as we start creating and collecting information and solutions. What were you going to say?
And different address the issues in different ways in coming weeks.
Right, in coming weeks. But we'll go to our next caller. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I think that we're living in a commercial age, and it's a type of commercialism that is grossly exploitative of labor, and it's manipulative of markets. It shouts about the wonders of capitalism, but it doesn't extend ownership automatically to the citizens here. So we continue to have many, many people who don't own property, don't own their own businesses, who are victimized by their non-property owning status. And so we have this two-part society. You have the sort of yuppie, easy living, always getting a pay raise, always buying a new car person or group. And then you have the working class, which has been victimized by the yuppies for the last 500 years. Now, the only reason why I hold out hope is that I know from studying history that if you go back to the early ages of capitalism or Christianity, the period from like 500 AD to about 1000 AD, societies were cooperative in nature. That is, the ruling classes just did their business, which was preparing for war and running the courts and setting up the market towns and things like that, but they didn't try to exploit the working class and get them to work for cheaper or take things from them. Their common property is one example, which was lost. So there were three ages. There was the cooperative age, there was a middle age, and now we're living in this commercial age. And so this is sort of to address the caller who called earlier. He was saying Europeans have taken everything, but I think that the good side of European history is that people have been able to manufacture high-quality products, specialty products, and sell them at an honest price. We used to have a cooperative society where there was no low-wage jobs. Everybody had a job. Everybody had the same thing. So I think that those who want diversity now are probably willing to see new immigrants come in and take opportunity, and they don't recognize that the older class of American citizens should be the first ones to be given a low-interest loan or a business ownership opportunity. But we're so mixed up by this growth agenda, the immigration agenda. We're all celebrating diversity. We don't see that the newcomers who are yuppies are getting in line ahead of American citizens who have worked hard for generations to make this society work. And yuppieism and greed and the yuppie control of society, it's not just an American or Anglo or European thing. If you look at China, 1.3 billion people. The economic report that I read or heard last said that 900 million of those people will not enjoy the economic rewards that are being generated in their new economy. In other words, they're going to be working slaves, and, you know, Chinese yuppies are willing to exploit Chinese labor to make a buck.
Caller, we're going to have to cut you off because we actually got a little distracted.
I had my 2 minutes, and I thank you for letting me talk.
All righty, thank you.
Okay.
We'll go to our next caller. Good morning. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Good to talk to you this morning. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Good. First of all, I want to say I really appreciate when you bring out the history of the housing. You know, you were talking about the redlining, the various things about the shifting around of population lines and things, the frustrations over the real estate, you know, issues that people don't, and people sometimes say, you know, various ones, different groups of people, you should get over it because that issue was long ended, you know. But it isn't.
No, it's not. You're right.
I mean, my God, even if you went back to slavery, somebody knows of their great-great-grandma or someone that was there. It's not that far ago. And that business about the real estate is just as long ago as when we were children, you and I. I mean, these historical facts are fresh.
Yes,
and relevant to what's going on today, but so many of us don't know. I mean, you've experienced, your families have experienced in the black community, but I am ignorant of that. You know, and the people, like you say, that are in the planning positions, it's how soon people forget and lose sight, I guess is kind of what I'm saying.
Yes.
Are you there?
Yes, we are.
We have to, it's just crazy. I mean, I was even thinking, it's kind of a leap here,
mm-hmm.
but I was even thinking in terms of our newscasters, you know, on television when they're mm-hmm. talking about environmental issues and things in the Northwest.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
They're outsiders. They come from outside, many of them. They've worked elsewhere in the media and they've come to Portland. Have no idea of the history of the Northwest in terms of, say, the issue of the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they're reporting, they're ignorant in their reporting. They lack background. And the same thing holds true in the issues you're discussing today.
Yes.
The people that are reporting on it, that are dealing with it, that are making policy, are ignorant of the background.
Yes.
Well, that is indeed part of the issue. And it's one of the things that we have to consider. But unfortunately, we're out of time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for your call.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Well, you've been listening to More Talk Radio, and we've been opening up just the beginning of a discussion around race and racism here in our community.
And the idea is, at the end of this, to have created some type of solution that we want to offer, even if it's a simple plan, to offer our listeners to say, okay, these are some things that we and you have come up with to consider as means of dismantling this machine so that we actually walk or talk and we're not progressive or liberal hypocrites.
Let me remind you, if you have some suggestions about how to shape this continuing conversation, please drop us a line here.
That's right. If you go to the KBOO website, you can send an email through the AM News at kboo.org, or you can, I believe our email links might be hot. I know mine is. Oh, you're happy. You want your anonymity? Okay.
I'll
take the heat. You'll find mine. You'll find my email link and you can send us emails. And of course, snail mail is wonderful too. And we do invite your comments and, your correspondence. In the meantime, this is, your community connection, KBOO Portland 90.7 in the metropolitan area, 91.9 in the gorge, 100.7 in the valley. This has been More Talk Radio. Stay tuned for the Old Mole Variety Hour here on your community connection, KBOO Portland.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Welcome to the Radio Zine for Wednesday, July 24th. Coming right up, we start off today with Old Mole Variety Hour, today hosted by Lori Mercier. At 10 o'clock on on Health Watch, local naturopathic doctor, Dr. David Naiman, hosts. And at 10:30, Chris Andre hosts Earth Watch. At 11 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! Stay tuned for all that great programming coming right up. We start now with the Old Mole Variety Hour.